one that I'm really focused on right now, and I have a couple of graduate students working on, is to try to identify different kinds of tests that will improve the animal's disease resilience. So the basic idea is to collect a blood sample. So just like a human would go in and the doctor would take a sample and try to learn something from the molecules, the chemicals in the blood, to try to predict outcomes for a human patient, that's what we're really trying to do with a pig.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Mycotoxins were found in over 90% of feed sampled in 2025. Don't let mycotoxins impact your pig's health and performance. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/fumzyme. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. Vaccinova, formulate to your needs, custom-made vaccines. Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at FortivaImpact.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Swine It podcast show. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host, and today I have Dr. Christopher Tuggle as my guest. Dr. Tuggle is a distinguished professor of agriculture in the Department of Animal Science at Iowa State University. Welcome to the Swine It podcast, Chris.
Thanks so much, Tara. I'm really happy to be here.
Absolutely. So today on our show, we're going to be discussing how Dr. Tuggle's work as a genome scientist and researcher can be translated into knowledge for the swine producer. But before we get started, Chris, will you share with us a little bit more about yourself and tell us about your path to working in this field?
So I grew up in Minnesota, which is a northern state in the U.S., and I'm now working in Iowa, so not very far away. But I did do postdoctoral work on both coasts, so in New York City and Los Angeles. So I decided I really wanted to come back to the Midwest, so that's why I came back here. So my background is I actually got undergraduate degrees in chemistry and then biochemistry PhD. And now I'm working in much more biological type of questions. And that's just a kind of a comment to people that, you know, your undergraduate degree is a good start, but you may find yourself in something quite different.
Yeah, absolutely. I did. I found myself doing something different in the veterinary profession than I expected as well. So I think a great message to young people in school or just entering their career.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
So let's dive into what research projects are you working on right now that may be relevant to our audience?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. So I really would say I'm working on all the projects involve the pig and trying to improve the pig for one reason or another. The one that I'm really focused on right now, and I have a couple of graduate students working on, is to try to identify different kinds of tests that will improve the animal's disease resilience. So the basic idea is to collect a blood sample. So just like a human would go in and the doctor would take a sample and try to learn something from the molecules, the chemicals in the blood, to try to predict outcomes for a human patient, that's what we're really trying to do with the pig. And disease resilience is always of interest to me because I'm studying in a larger academic context the immune system and trying to understand the genes in the immune system and the activities that they control. And so if we can get a blood sample, we can collect different types of measurements. Of course, something like a complete blood count, like you would have in a human or any animal, which gives you some idea of the inflammatory state of that animal, the different components in the blood. But you can also do much more detailed analysis. In genomics, we can collect the gene expression pattern of the genes, and that's often called transcriptomics. And those transcripts tell us about the activity and the state of those cells in the pig. And so we can look at pigs that we know are healthy or know are sick and try to get a reference, and then collect a sample and try to predict whether it's going to be resistant or non-resistant to disease if we then expose the animal to disease. And we can do that in a laboratory, or we can do that very practically by taking animals from clean spaces into more commercially relevant spaces that are not controlled for having bacteria around, for having viruses around, which is very common, of course. And we're really trying to understand whether we can predict the future growth or future disease resistance of that animal by looking earlier in the blood sample. So that's really one big project that we're working on. I'm working on that with a number of researchers at Iowa State and in Canada that's collecting all the data for us, and we're relying on them to have collected all that material.
Yeah, very interesting. So do you think this would be, you know, let's fast forward a few years and say, would genetics companies use this type of technology then for a selection and breeding program, or where would it go from there?
Yeah, there's a couple of possibilities. I could introduce a little bit more of the genetic component of the project. It's a large collaborative project. So there's several thousand pigs actually going 60 at a time through a process where we collect the blood sample on a young, healthy pig, and the pig goes into the barn, and the veterinarians measure growth and check for disease and treat the animals. So we have the number of treatments, how well the animal's growing, but we also collect the blood sample and we do the genetics on those animals. So we use different kinds of tools in genomics to measure the relative genetic similarity between animals. We can measure the genetic variation at many different places in the genome with different chips that were developed from genomics. And so that we have that genomics. So we've already done some analysis and found that there are some genes associated with animals that do better in the diseased environment versus animals that don't do as well. And so you could already think about that, using that as a selection tool. What we're trying to add to that is because genetics is very powerful, one of the most powerful measures we have, but your phenotype, your performance, is also dependent on the environment. And that's exactly what we're seeing, is that the genetic companies don't want to expose their precious breeding stock to any disease, right? So they have to keep them in a very clean environment. So if we only measure performance in a clean environment, that's not reflective of the industry. So that's really the basis of this project, is can we see if there's a genetic propensity to do well in the dirty environment, not just the clean environment. And so that's a big part of it. But as I said, you know, the genetics can only predict a portion of the performance. That's called heredity, and whether a trait like growth is heritable, and it is, but it's not the whole story. And so the idea is there are traits and molecular differences that are due to environment as well as genetics. So, for example, you know, one person will have a very strong reaction to a bee sting, and then another person won't. And that's partly genetics. Significant part is genetics, but it's also what their state was, whether that person was already sick and perhaps already inflamed and had a stronger reaction. And it's also well known that if you have one kind of an infection, like a viral infection, and you get further infected by like a bacterial infection, that can be serious, can be extremely serious compared to someone that wasn't previously infected. So we have the ability to try to add to the genetics by looking at the transcriptomics, the gene expression, because we can determine whether an animal is inflamed or has a propensity to be much more responsive to an inflammatory stimulus. And so when we measure the response of the animal to the environment by looking at, for example, the gene expression, then we can see what's the genetics, what's the environmental response that animal has, and we can try to put the two together and perhaps have an even better test. But yes, the genetics is the straightforward thing that we can already do, and we're just trying to add to that.
Ah, that's very interesting. As a swine veterinarian, it gives me hope that we'll have a pig that's, you know, more resistant to the diseases that we already have and those that are emerging, right, that we don't even know about yet at this point. That's going to be a challenge.
Right.
So quick follow-up question. How do you, let's say that there's a blood test that is able to detect these genes. How is that passed on? So, you know, and then maybe in these clean multiplication and genetic nucleus herds, they're able to, select for it. Is it, then do you go into, the heritability type processes of how do you get this passed down into generations to the producer, to the commercial producer that's out there listening?
Yeah, that's a really important point. I emphasize the fact that the RNA patterns, the gene expression, is responsive to the environment, but it is also heritable. You can show that there's really two components when we measure blood, because when we take a blood sample, we're measuring the gene activity of all the cells in the blood, but the total amount of expression at any one gene is measured by both how much it's expressed in any one cell, but also the composition of the blood. So some animals will have a higher number than average of, say, neutrophils, which is very important for early response to disease. Other animals might have more lymphocytes, where they may have a better response to a vaccine, because that's what the lymphocytes do. So if we measure something in the blood, we get several pieces of information. One, which is cell composition of the blood. And cell composition is also heritable. One pig will pass on to its offspring a lot of that characteristic. So you could imagine that offspring will have more neutrophils, for example, if the animal had a neutrophil. So we can hope in the future to add to the genetic component, which we can already do, and of course that heritability is very high. The heritability of the variants is very high. How much the variants can contribute to an animal's performance is medium. It's in the, heritability is in less than half. So half of the variation is due to genetics. That's still, just under half is actually quite a strong genetic component. So what we can try to do is add to the straightforward genetic testing, which is already possible. The problem is that the genetic testing is easy, but the measurement of the phenotype is what the difficult thing was. The measurement of the performance was difficult, and the producers have not been able to do that very well in their nucleus herds where their breeding stock is, and that's why we're adding that ability to measure the phenotype and try to associate improved phenotype or improved performance against the genetics. And now we're adding against, the transcriptomics, the environmental effects. So that's sort of a long answer, but basically we can definitely add improvement if we are measuring these traits in the environments that we need to measure them in. And it just hasn't been possible in the past. So they've been focused on things they can measure well, which are, growth and carcass characteristics and things like that. But what we're hoping to do is improve disease resistance as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In some field research I've been involved with in my career, we've kind of stumbled across some things nutritionally that were helpful in disease. I guess not necessarily mitigation, but some pigs just didn't get as sick in the same barn that were on a certain diet. And so, but we really wouldn't have known that unless they were out in a commercial research setting. And it was a nutritional component that, you know, helped them with, you know, some inflammatory processes. So it is hard in research to look at things that, you know, that basically are impacted by, you know, different things in the environment that in a controlled research setting, you can't mimic. Right. So I can appreciate your challenges.
Well, and that's why the project is so large, is that these effects are often quite small when you measure them against the average of the population. So, you know, a really superior animal may only be 10% more resistant. You know, it grows 10% faster, or it has 10% more treatments by the veterinarian. So that's why we have to measure hundreds and hundreds of animals to see those smaller differences. But the great thing about genetic improvement is that once you make that 10% recognition, and if it's heritable, then the next generation can be 10%. And then perhaps you can find another variant that will add to that and slowly build resistance, like we've built things like milk yield in cattle or growth rate and carcass characteristics in pigs. Those are only slightly more heritable, but they're easy to measure. So that's the thing. You can measure hundreds and hundreds of animals for growth rate very easily. They do it as part of just regular husbandry. So we've been able to improve things like growth rate, feed efficiency. It's a little bit harder, but that's possible as well. But disease has always been the one that's just very difficult to measure. And we're hoping that we can make some progress with this, you know, quite large project.
Yeah. So when you mentioned a quite large project, just to give us a little bit of the scope, you said it's a very large, you know, group and a lot of researchers. Tell us about the size and scope of a project like this.
It started with my colleague, Jack Deckers, in the department here. We've collaborated for more than a couple of decades now. But it starts with cohorts of animals around 50 to 60 come into a barn. And that barn is in one part of Canada, one province of Canada, actually in Quebec. The collaboration is also with groups in Alberta, the University of Alberta. And then Jack Deckers and myself and several other people at Iowa State University. So it's and there are people in several other provinces in Canada. The reason that it's in Canada is because we were able to get funds from Genome Canada. I can't remember exactly how much it was. It was a number of years ago, but it was close to $1 million Canadian dollars and converted to US. It's still a very large amount of money. And then we've received two additional grants from the USDA to do more of the RNA work and to do additional work that Jack has found some new work, new results, and he was able to get a third grant from the USDA. So I want to emphasize that this kind of sort of academic question, really whether we could even measure the genetic control of disease resistance, is really funded by governments. It's too difficult for a company to really fund this, and it's expensive because those 60 animals are repeated over again every 6 or 8 weeks for several years, and so the total number of animals that went through this process is over 3,000, and so 3,000 animals were transferred from breeding companies. So each breeding company gives cohorts of animals. And that's one of the reasons why it was very supported by the breeding industry in Canada, because it's going to be directly relevant to the pig industry. Those come in every 6 weeks. And so you can imagine how many cohorts of animals had to go through that process, had lots of veterinarians go all the way to market. And so there's an enormous number of measurements on those animals, the average daily gain, like I said, the health records, water usage. So there's many, many parts of this project. I'm really just on the sort of the molecular long-term kind of goals to try to see if we collect that blood sample at a few weeks of age before it goes into this challenge, you know, what can we learn from that sort of as prior predictors of the future. So To give you an idea of the people involved, I mean, there are dozens of people that handle the animals every 6 weeks. Now that set of cohorts has already completed that part, and now we're analyzing all the samples. But literally tens of thousands of samples were collected, because many, many samples were collected on every animal. And we've already done the genotyping on over 3,000 animals, and Jack has already completed some genetic analysis and does show that there is the potential for selecting for resistance. I should qualify that. He really calls it resilience, because it's very difficult for an animal to be resistant, completely resistant. But a resilient animal is the one we want, the one that can do well even in a challenging environment. So we're calling it resilience. So we're looking at animals that do well under that challenge. And so that what I mean by do well is by grow well with minimal disease and minimal, or I should say maximal animal health, which is really what we're looking at.
Yeah, that sounds like an enormous feat and a lot of people's efforts, time and money, and certainly appreciate how hard it is to get funding and to keep funding. And so, you know, us as producers and supporters of the industry need to keep making sure we express our thoughts and needs for research and science to help us.
We hope that the industry can take advantage of some of the results that we have. We'd love to be able to see it tested in the industry itself.
So what about other research projects or something you think might be applicable to our industry or interesting to our audience?
Well, I guess I could say a couple of things. One is we're going a little bit further trying to come up with a way of, it's more of a statistical approach, but the idea is once we take the blood sample, if we have a bunch of reference gene expression patterns, we can then predict the composition of the blood. So in other words, we can do a statistical test called deconvolution. And essentially, it's a blood sample that we take and we match it against our reference patterns and say, all right, well, based on all that expression, we can predict that that animal has more neutrophils or more lymphocytes or more T cells or B cells or natural killer cells or plasmacytoid dendritic cells. There's 8 or 9 major cell types in the blood. And we can then, it's just additional ways that we can collect traits. And now we can have a trait of the fraction of natural killer cells, which are important for viral infections, for example. And so we might find, because we've never been able to measure it before, but we might find that the natural killer population or the plasmacytoid dendritic cell population, which is very important for vaccination response, maybe those cells, the percentage of those cells or the number of those cells is a huge indicator for better response to vaccination or better control of vaccine virus. And so that's a way for us to add information to these really big projects. And I've got a student that's using a lot of machine learning to try to take all of this data and try to come up with those kinds of predictors. So not just gene expression, but then what can you do with that expression and try to add, you know, information and content to this big project? Because it's a one-off. You know, it's so big and so large that it probably won't be done the same way again by really almost anybody. It's something that we're publishing, so that's why it might not need to be done. But that would be one project that's on the industry side. I could tell you a little bit about a project that's more on the biomedical side. We have, again, collaborating with Jack, he had herds of animals that he was working on for residual feed intake. So the feed intake is can be measured in many different ways, but he was looking to try to improve efficiency of eating feed and growing. So it's called residual feed intake. So to try to have something to genetically compare, he had a low line and a high line for residual feed intake. And what we found very serendipitously was that in one of those two lines, there were animals that did very poorly. They had a lot of difficulty. And when we actually collaborated with another group to test whether they whether the whole population was more or less resistant to PRRS virus infection, some of those animals didn't survive at all. So we really looked into it, and it turned out that a very small population of animals had a natural mutation and a mutation that was Mendelian in nature. So 100%, it was very strong effect mutation. Not like the mutations that we use in animal breeding, which are very small effects, and we accumulate many, many small effects. This was a very, very large effect passed on from parent to offspring, like we would normally think about for a major gene. And what was interesting about it is that it caused the pigs not to have an adaptive immune system. So they didn't have any functioning way to respond to a vaccine or respond to and create memory cells that would allow you to be resistant to an infection. The innate system was there, so they could initially respond, but they really had no way of adapting. So they were very susceptible to disease. The reason that's interesting is that there has been animals, mice in the biomedical community have been used for many years that have that same trait. They don't have an immune system. And so they can't really attack very well human cells that are put into these mice. And so you might imagine those mice can be used as a model for humans. We can put in a human cancer and then try to add a drug to that mouse and see if that cancer can be killed. And you would like to do that in an in vivo setting, in an animal, rather than just in the petri dish. And so it's an animal model. But no one had created or no one had ever found a large animal immune deficient situation. And so we published really the first example of that. And we've received money from NIH, two fairly significant grants in the millions of dollars, to try to develop this as a model for many human uses in biomedical research. The biggest ones are there's been a big push to use stem cells to create a therapeutic cell to give to a patient. So the classic example is, what do we do with someone with a severe heart attack? Is one of their major cures is to receive a heart transplant. But of course, heart transplants are pretty difficult and very fraught with danger, but also there aren't enough hearts to go around for all the people with severe heart disease. So one thing that you could potentially do is repair that person's heart rather than just replace it. And so this is called regenerative medicine, and they need to test all of these therapeutic cells. People have taken stem cells, converted them to heart cells, and then start to work with them in mice. But the mouse's heart beats very, very fast. I think it's clearly, it's close to 200 beats per minute, and it's very small. And so I've talked to heart surgeons that say, I can't operate on that. But the pig heart is much closer in size, of course, and is much more close in physiology. And so they want to use the pig model. So we're trying to get to a point where we have a clean, healthy animal that they could put these therapeutic cells in. So, for example, and implant them into a pig heart. And we've worked with, kind of serendipitously, another group in Canada, but we worked with several groups. But the group in Canada has been able to inject their therapeutic cells into the pigs that we developed and grew up, and the Toronto group used those pigs. And we were able to see that the cells in the heart were able to interact with the cells that they put in. There was some issue with arrhythmia because the heart cells that they put in were beating slightly differently than the heart cells that were in the heart itself. But actually it was a success, at least a partial success, because it showed that the heart could accept some of these cells. And so We're working with them. We're also working with a number of other groups. There's many other organs that would like that people would like to replace or repair. And all that testing has to be done in a large animal model if they're going to replace a large organ, for example, or replace a large fraction of that organ, or repair something that is much more similar to a pig than in a human. So that's another project. It's completely different from the disease resistance project. Really, the only thing in common is that we're doing a lot of same measurements, and it's being done in pigs, but for a very different purpose. And so I've got a technician that works on that project, and I've had graduate students publish a lot of that work to show that the pig is a good model, and that we can put cancer in, we can put these heart cells in. There's one other thing that I could mention is that we'd also like to put a human immune system in these pigs, because they don't have their own, and it would improve the model, but it would also allow us to do something really pie in the sky, but maybe hopeful in the future. The perfect model for like a cancer patient would be to put their cancer in, but also put their immune system in. And that's becoming more possible. We're getting to the point where we can put a human stem cell, like a hematopoietic stem cell, in and start to see some development of human B cells and T cells, some myeloid cells that are human and are growing in our pigs. So maybe in the long run, we might have a model where you're not only showing that the cells will grow in the organ and maybe repair it, but you can then also start to do things like a very sophisticated analysis of the immune system and the cancer, or the immune system and the new repaired organ, for example.
Well, I think that's been really interesting, and it's amazing what we're going to be able to do in the future.
Right.
So today we've been discussing how Dr. Christopher Tuggle, a distinguished professor of animal science at Iowa State University, is working in the field of genomics to improve disease resilience in the pig and advance overall health of swine, and also learn about what he's doing in collaboration to help with a pig model for human medicine. It's been very, very interesting to learn about that. So, Dr. Tuggle, do you have any final thoughts or take-homes for our listeners on today's conversation before we wrap up?
Well, I think maybe go back to what we said initially. I mean, I'm working in immunity, and I didn't think I was going to do that when I graduated with a chemistry degree, but I was really interested in molecules and really medicine and the body itself. And I've just ended up being working with a pig model, but also trying to help the industry here in my department. So, just keep your eyes open and your ears to the ground for all kinds of opportunities. I've really enjoyed working with the pigs.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Vaxinova, formulate to your needs, custom-made vaccines. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes nephironine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
So we're rounding out our time together. I want to say thank you to our listeners. And if you have questions or comments, send those through your podcast platform. Also, if you liked our show, give us a thumbs up. And before we end, the trademark of our show is to ask our guests a few thought-provoking questions to expand our knowledge and keep us thinking. So, Chris, what is a book or resource that is your go-to in the area of expertise?
I guess what I would say, the resource that I really would use is there are tools online to analyze genomes, and there's something called a genome browser. So just like your web browser, I can browse the pig's genome. I can look to see what genes are in what part of the chromosome, and I I might have a, you know, something interesting in a particular place. That's just another whole area of genetics and genomics that people maintain. So again, it's a huge, resource that is developed and maintained by, you know, government funding and enormous number of researchers that really help by maintaining something like that. It's just like an enormous library that you can use your computer to scan through.
Interesting. I didn't know that existed. So, of course, I always learn something new from my guests. So how about a resource or book outside of the swine industry or genomics, your area of expertise that you think might be of interest to us?
I guess I would say that I have a hobby of fountain pens, and I do a lot of technical things, and I do most of my writing using a computer, but I like to get away from that a little bit. And fountain pens are like a really old thing. Probably none of your listeners probably uses a fountain pen, but I find it fun. I can use lots of different colors. I'm not stuck with blue, my blue ballpoint, right? And there's a lot of websites that tell you about how to, I started with vintage fountain pens. So I have really old ones that are lots of different ways of filling them. They talk about it. It's really just a controlled leak out of a pen. So it's just as fun. I have lots of different fountain pens. It's something I do as a hobby.
Ah, very cool. Never would have thought of that. But I did go to a country school when I was a lot younger, and they had the desks with the little place to put the inkwell. Yeah, so brings back some memories. So very cool. So how about share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful professionals apart from others?
I guess I would say flexibility and willingness to work with different people for different purposes. I mean, I work with people that are calling me up and saying, I'd like to use your pig, your immune deficient pig, to, you know, put a new artificial device in or something like that. And they're very focused on one area, but then I also have undergraduates that want to learn how pigs work. So, you know, each day is new, and I think to be successful, you have to be flexible and willing to, think outside the box and think and develop projects and be successful with lots of different kinds of people.
Yeah, absolutely. From what you described to us, you have networks that, you know, go from, you know, the human medicine to genomics to the swine production. And so that's what makes our jobs fun is the wide variety, and definitely to have flexibility in your thought process and what could be.
Right. I agree with that.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tuggle, for being my guest today, and really enjoyed our conversation. And thanks again. This is another episode of the SwineIt Podcast.
Thanks so much, Tara. Happy to be on.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.